5. Fallen with the Night. The gas lamps gleam in a golden line. The ruby lights of the hansoms shine, glance and flicker like fireflies bright. The wind has fallen with the night, and once again the town seems fair, thwart the mist that hangs i' the air. Amy Levy, A March Day in London. Cordelia leaned close to Lucy as they jolted through the streets in the Institute's carriage, surrounded by the blurred traffic of omnibuses, motorcars and pedestrians. Advertisements whirled past. The Horseshoe Hotel, Three Guineas Stout, New Palace Steamers. Signs advertising tailors and fishmongers, hair tonic and cheap printing. A world incredibly distant from the one Cordelia had just left behind in Regent's Park. A world where small things mattered. Matthew was sitting across from them on the upholstered carriage seat, gripping the seat cushions with his fists. His hair stuck out madly. Blood and ichor stained his linen jacket and silk tie. The moment the demons had gone, James had taken off on Balios, one of his father's horses, hoping to reach the Institute and prepare them for the arrival of the wounded. Charles had bolted off with Ariadne in the consul's carriage, leaving Matthew to catch a ride with Lucy and Cordelia. Alistair had returned to Kensington to tell Sonar what had happened. Cordelia was half glad for the ichor burns on her hands. She had told him she would need treatment in the Institute infirmary, and besides, she could potentially stay to offer help and assistance. After all, they had to be mindful of the impression they were making on the enclave. "Now," he had demanded, dark eyes snapping. "At this moment, you're worried about the impression we're making in London." "It's important, Alistair," she'd replied. "It's for father." Alistair hadn't protested further. Cordelia had been a little surprised. She knew he thought her scheming was pointless. They had argued about it at Sirenworth, and she told him she couldn't comprehend why he wouldn't stand behind their father with her. Why he seemed to feel that there was no hope when they hadn't yet tried everything. He'd only told her she didn't understand.
"I still don't see how it's possible," said Lucy. "Demons don't come out during the day. They simply don't."
"I've heard of them appearing under thick cloud cover before," said Cordelia. "If no sunlight could get through." Matthew gave a hoarse laugh. "That was no natural storm. Yet I have never heard of demons who could control the weather either." He drew a silver flask from his waistcoat pocket. Lucy shot him a sharp look before glancing away.
"Did you see the wounds?" she asked. "I have never seen anything like it. Barbara's skin was turning black at the edges where she was bitten."
"You have never seen anything like it because there never has been anything like this," said Matthew. "Demons who bring their own night with them, who attack us when we are vulnerable because we believe we cannot be assailed."
"Matthew," said Cordelia sharply, "stop frightening Lucy, when we do not even know what we are dealing with yet."
He took a swig from the flask as their carriage rattled through Ludgate Circus and onto Fleet Street. Cordelia could smell the sharp, sweet perfume of the alcohol, familiar as childhood.
"Lucy doesn't get frightened, do you, Luce?"
Lucy crossed her arms over her chest.
"I am frightened for Barbara and Ariadne and for Piers," she said. "Are you not concerned? Barbara is our family, and Ariadne one of the kindest people I know."
"There is no special protection in this world for kind people," Matthew began, and broke off as Cordelia glared at him. He took another swig from his flask and bared his teeth.
"Yes, I'm being a beast. I know that perfectly well."
"Then stop doing it," said Cordelia. "My father always said that to panic before you have all the facts was to fight the enemy's battle for him."
"But who is the enemy?" said Lucy.
"Demons, I suppose.
But demons usually attack without strategy or method. These demons avoided every mundane in the park and went straight for us.
Demons aren't always random in their actions, Cordelia said. Perhaps a warlock who has summoned a pack of demons is responsible, or even a greater demon amusing themselves.
Ordinary demons are like animals. But if I understand it rightly, greater demons can be quite like people.
They had reached the Institute. Matthew shot her a swift, surprised look as the carriage rolled under the gate with its Latin motto, Pulvis et umbra sumus. We are dust and shadows. As they came to a sliding stop in the courtyard, Matthew reached to throw the carriage door open. He leaped down and turned to help Cordelia and Lucy after him. The courtyard was already full of carriages. Cordelia recognized the symbol of the Inquisitor's family, an arched bridge on one of them. She could also see Balios, his reins tied to a post near the front steps. His flanks were foamy with sweat. James must have ridden hell for leather through the streets. As another carriage began to rattle under the gate, Matthew glared at his flask, which was apparently empty. I think I'll take a walk, he said. I shall return shortly.
Matthew? Lucy looked horrified. But the infirmary! And Thomas needs us!
I don't like illness, Matthew said shortly and walked away, clearly choosing his steps very carefully. Cordelia wondered what had been in the flask. Something quite strong, she guessed. Lucy looked furious.
How can he?
She broke off as the new carriage came to a stop, and Gabriel and Cecily Lightwood spilled out. Gabriel looked harried. Cecily beside him was carrying a very small boy, dark-haired and blue-eyed. Cordelia guessed he was Alexander, Lucy's youngest cousin.
Lucy,
Cecily cried, hurrying toward her niece. Cordelia hung back with a feeling of awkwardness. It was a sharp reminder of how far away from all this she had grown up. Not just geographically, but also socially. Alistair had at least had time at the academy. This world, Lucy and James's world, was a world of family and friends who loved each other, but did not know her at all.
But I don't understand, Cecily was saying. I know what Anna's message said, but a demon attack in broad daylight? It makes no sense at all. Could it not have been something else?
Perhaps, Aunt Cecily, but these creatures left the sort of wounds that demons leave, said Lucy, and their blood was ichor. Gabriel put a hand on Lucy's shoulder. Half the enclave has been dispatched to the park to help those who are still there and determine what occurred. It is most likely a freak occurrence, Luce. Horrible, but unlikely to ever happen again.
And Jem, Brother Zachariah, will be here with the other Silent Brothers, said Cecily, glancing up at the Institute. They will heal Barbara and the others. I know they will.
Brother Zachariah, Jem. Of course he would be here, Cordelia realized. Jem Carstairs was a dedicated Silent Brother and loyal to the London Institute.
I could talk to him, she thought, about my father.
Jem was here to heal, she knew, but her father needed help as much as anyone, and there were other Silent Brothers in the Institute. Looking from Gabriel to Cecily, she said, Would you mind if I accompanied you to the infirmary? If there are bandages there, I could wrap my hands.
Lucy looked remorseful. Daisy, your hands! I should have given you 12 Iratzis, 100 Iratzis. It is only that you were so brave about your injuries.
Oh dear. Cordelia hadn't meant to make Lucy feel guilty.
Truly, it only hurts a little.
Cecily smiled at her.
Spoken like a true Carstairs. Jem would never admit when he was in pain either.
She kissed the top of Alexander's head as he fussed to be put down.
Come, Lucy. Let us get your future parabatai to the infirmary.
James had never seen the infirmary like this before.
Of course, he'd heard stories from his mother and father about the aftermath of the Clockwork War, the dead and the wounded. But during his lifetime, there had rarely ever been more than one or two patients in the sick room. Thomas had once ended up there for a week when he'd fallen out of a tree and broken his leg. They'd stayed up nights playing cards and eating Bridget's jam tarts. James had been disappointed when the healing runes finally worked and Thomas went home. The scene was very different now. The room was already crowded. There were many shadow hunters who had been burned by ichor or who had cuts and bruises. An impromptu nursing station had been set up at the counter where Tessa and Will, with help from the Silent Brothers, were dealing out bandages and healing runes to whoever needed them. The three more seriously injured shadow hunters had been placed in beds at the end of the room, where a screen partially shielded them from the chaos in the rest of the infirmary. James could not help looking, though, especially at Thomas. The rest of the Lightwoods had not arrived yet, and Thomas sat silently by Barbara's side. James had tried to sit with him, but Thomas had said he would rather be alone with Barbara. He was holding his sister's hand as Uncle Jem tended to her. She lay still, her only movement, her breathing. Brother Shadrach, Brother Enoch, and Jem had arrived only moments after James had brought the news of the attack to the Institute. Shadrach leaned over Piers, treating him with a tincture meant to replace some of his lost blood. Brother Enoch crouched by Ariadne, his aspect grim. Inquisitor Bridgestock and his wife were huddled not far from their daughter, exchanging fearful looks. They had been a childless couple before they had adopted orphaned Ariadne from the Bombay Institute, and they had always treated her like a precious treasure. Charles slumped in a chair nearby. Like Barbara, Ariadne was motionless save for her shallow breathing. One could see the tracery of her veins beneath the skin of her wrists and temples. James was still filthy with grass, dirt, and sweat. Nevertheless, he stayed behind the counter, cutting and rolling bandages. If Thomas would not have him, he would help in any other way he could. He could hear snippets of conversation floating above the hushed stir of voices. It was demons, Townsend. Or at least it was either demons or some creature we've never seen before. These are the marks of demon attacks, of claws and teeth. There is no wound that a downworlder can inflict that is immune to healing runes, but these are. We must find what poison is in their bodies and work to cure that. But daylight? Who is still at the park? Does anyone have a list of names of those who attended the picnic? We must be certain not a one was left behind. James thought of Grace. He wished he'd been able to speak to her after the attack, but Balios, though nearly 28, was the fastest horse in the park by far, and only James could ride him. James or Lucy, and Lucy had wanted to remain with Cordelia. In the end, it had been Christopher, looking more frightened than he had during the demon battle, who had offered to take Grace back to Chiswick in his carriage, Charles, of course, having already rushed to the Institute with Ariadne. James could not help but dread Tatiana's reaction to the attack. It seemed entirely within her usual behaviour to decide London was too dangerous and drag Grace back to Idris. James? The voice was silent, an echo in his head. He knew who it was instantly, of course. Only Silent Brothers spoke this way, and he would never mistake Jem for anyone else. James, might I have a word with you? James glanced up to see Jem, tall and dark in his parchment-coloured robes, leaving the infirmary. Setting the bandages down, he slipped out the door and into the corridor outside. He followed his uncle to the music room, neither of them speaking as they went. The corridors of the Institute had been redesigned by Tessa some years ago, the dark Victorian wallpaper gone in favour of light paint and true stone. Elegant carved sconces emerged from the walls at spaced intervals. Each was in the shape of the symbol of a shadow hunter family. Carstairs, Carr, Herondale, Rayburn, Starkweather, Lightwood, Blackthorn, Monteverdi, Rosales, Bellefleur. It was James's mother's way of saying that they were all shadow hunters together, all with an equal place in the Institute. Not that the Clave had always treated his mother as if she were equal, James thought. He pushed the thought away, the whispers about his mother, himself, and Lucy always made his blood boil. The music room was rarely used. Lucy was not musical at all, and James had played the piano for a few years and then abandoned it. Golden sunlight poured through the windows, illuminating dancing trails of dust motes. A grand piano loomed in the corner, half covered by a white drop cloth. Jem's violin had pride of place. A Stradivarius carved of mellow wood, it rested in an open case atop a high table. James had seen his father come into the room just to touch the violin sometimes, a faraway look in his eyes. He wondered if he would do the same with Matthew's belongings if, one day, he lost his parapetai. He pushed the thought away. Matthew was like food, sleep, breathing. Doing without him would not be possible. "I got your message," Jem said. "The one you sent last night." James started. I had nearly forgotten. He could see himself in a gold-framed mirror on the wall. There was grass in his hair and a bloody scratch on his cheek. He looked like an escapee from Bedlam. "I'm not sure it matters now." "It might," Jem said. He seemed tense, if one could ever describe a silent brother as tense. "Barbara was still conscious when I arrived here. She whispered to me of you." "Of me?" James was startled. "She said, James must be protected. Did you turn into a shadow at the lake?" "No," James said. "I saw the shadow realm last night and again today, but I did not become a shadow myself. I was able to control it." Jem relaxed minutely. "James," he said, "you know that I have been trying to discover which greater demon your grandfather was." "Your ability." "It's not an ability," James said. "It's a curse." "It is not a curse." Jem's tone was sharp. "It is not a curse any more than the magic warlocks do is a curse, or the ability your mother has is a curse." "You have always said it is dangerous," said James. "Some gifts are dangerous, and it is a gift, though it may come from the bloodline of fallen angels." "A gift I cannot use for anything," James said. "Last night at the party when I slipped into darkness, I saw Barbara pulled to the ground by a shadow. Then today at the lake she was dragged to earth by a demon with its teeth in her leg." He set his jaw. "I don't know what it means. Nor did the visions help me or allow me to help Barbara or the others." He hesitated. "Perhaps if we went back to the lessons, we could learn more about the shadow realm, whether it is perhaps trying to give me some sort of sign." "It would be wise for us to continue the lessons, yes," Jem said, "but we cannot begin now. The poison consuming those who were attacked is like nothing I have ever seen, nor do the other brothers know it. We must bend all our will now to finding the cure." The door opened and Will stuck his head into the music room. He looked weary, his shirt sleeves rolled to the elbow, his shirt stained with tinctures and salve. Still, he smiled when he saw James and Jem. "Is everything all right?" "Uncle Jem was worried about me," said James, "but I am quite well." Will came up to his son and pulled him into a quick, rough hug. He said, "I am glad to hear it, Jamie Bach. Gideon and Sophie have arrived, and to see them with Barbara." He kissed the top of James's head. "It does not bear thinking of." "I should return to the infirmary," said Jem. "There is still much for me to do." Will nodded, releasing James. "I know Gideon and Sophie will feel better if you were the one tending Barbara. Not to insult Brother Shadrach," who I'm sure is an excellent and well-respected member of the Brotherhood. Jem shook his head, which was as close as he got to smiling, and the three of them left the music room. To James's surprise, Thomas was waiting in the corridor outside, looking hollow-eyed. Will exchanged a quick glance with James and left his son alone with Thomas. It was good, James thought, to have a father who understood the significance of friendship. Thomas spoke as soon as the adults were out of earshot. "My parents are here," he said in a low voice. "James, I need something to do. Something that might help my sister. I think I might go mad otherwise." "Of course. We must all help Barbara," said James. "Thomas, in the park, Barbara saw the demons before everyone else. She was the one who warned me." "She had perfect sight even before she got her voyance rune," Thomas said. "Perhaps because my mother was a sighted mundane before she became a shadow hunter. We've never been sure. Barbara wasn't terribly interested in testing her abilities, but she always had unusually keen senses." "It is almost as if she could glimpse my shadow realm," James murmured, remembering what Barbara had said, that she had been able to see ragged black shapes at the ball, that she had felt herself drawn down. An idea had begun to take shape in his mind. He wondered if he should go back and speak of it to Jem, but no. Jem would never let him do it. He would think it too dangerous, reckless even. But James was feeling reckless, and from the look of it, Thomas was too. "We need to round up Matthew and Christopher," James said. "I have an idea of what we can do." Some of the colour came back to Thomas's face. "Christopher has just returned from Chiswick," he said. "I saw him in the entry hall. But as for Matthew..." Cordelia had determined to make herself useful in the infirmary. It was the only way she could be sure she wouldn't be tossed out on her ear. After all, none of the wounded were her relatives or even her friends, and she wasn't likely to be making many new friends at this rate. Lucy had been recruited for duty as well. Dozens of labelled jars and pots had been taken down from the cupboards behind the marble-topped counter, where Tessa was presiding over the dispensing of ingredients for tinctures and potions. Cordelia's own hands had been slathered in salve and wrapped in bandages. They looked like white paws as she handled the mortar and pestle she'd been given. The front of the infirmary was taken up with those who had scratches, sprains, and burns. The tinctures and salves were mostly for them. Lucy was busy handing them out, her cheerful flow of chatter audible over the low hum of other conversation. A screen had been pulled in front of the far end of the room, and Cordelia was almost glad for it. It was too awful to see Sophie and Gideon Lightwood break down by Barbara's bedside, or even Rosamond sitting silently by her brother. Cordelia was sorry she had ever harboured uncharitable thoughts towards the Wentworths. No one deserved this. "It's all right." Tessa's voice was gentle. James's mother was busy finely chopping mugwort into a bowl. She cast a sympathetic glance at Cordelia. "I have seen the Silent Brothers bring people back from much worse." Cordelia shook her head. "I have not. I suppose I have been very sheltered." "We all have been, for a time," said Tessa. "The natural state of shadow hunters is battle. When it is always ongoing, there is no time to stop and think that this is not an ideal condition for happiness. Shadow hunters are not suited to a halcyon state, yet we have had that time for the past decade or so. Perhaps we have begun to think ourselves invincible." "People are only invincible in books," said Cordelia. "I think you will find most of the time not even then," said Tessa. "But at least we can always pick up a book and read it anew. Stories offer 1,000 fresh starts." It was true, Cordelia thought. She had read the story of Leila and Majnun 1,000 times, and each time the beginning was a thrill, even though she knew and dreaded the end. "The only equivalent in real life is memory," Tessa said, looking up as Will Herondale came into the room, followed by Cousin Jem. But memories can be bitter as well as sweet. Will smiled at his wife. James's parents always looked at each other with such love, it was nearly painful to see, before heading toward the small group of Lightwoods gathered around Barbara. Cordelia heard them greet him, and Sophie's worried tones, but her gaze was on Jem. He had come toward the counter and was reaching for several jars of mixed herbs. It was now or never.
"Cousin Jem," Cordelia whispered, "I need to speak with you."
Jem glanced up in surprise. Cordelia tried not to start. It was always strange to see a silent brother this close. She remembered all the times her mother had suggested her father go to the Basilius, the Shadowhunter Hospital in Alicante, to cure his lingering illness. Elias had always insisted he did not wish to go anywhere where he would be surrounded by silent brothers. They rattled his nerves, he claimed. Most of them were like creatures of ice and blood. Ivory robes marked in red, skin drained of colour, scarred with red runes. Most were without hair, and worse, had their eyes sewn shut, their sockets sunken and hollow. Jem did not look like that. His face was young and very still, like the face of a knight from the Crusades carved on a marble tomb. His hair was a tangle of black and white threads. His eyes were permanently shut, as if in prayer. "Are you all right, Cordelia?" asked Jem's voice in her mind. Tessa immediately moved to shield the two of them from the gaze of the rest of the sick room. Cordelia tried to appear as if she was absolutely fascinated with her mortar and pestle, energetically mashing together feverfew and golden seal.
"Please," she whispered. "Have you seen Baba, my father, in Idris? How is he? When can he come home?"
There was a long pause. "I have seen him," said Cousin Jem. For a moment, Cordelia let herself remember her father, truly remember him. Her father had taught her to fight. Her father had his faults, but he was never cruel. And when he did pay Cordelia some mind, his attention made her feel 10 feet tall. It often felt as though Alistair and Sonar were made of different stuff than Cordelia, glass or metal with edges that could cut, but Elias was the one who was like her. "Memories can be bitter as well as sweet," she murmured.
"You are a silent brother. I know my father was not always welcoming to you."
"Never think I am resentful of the distance he kept," said Jem. "I would do anything I could for you and our family."
"He wrote me a note, asking me to believe in him. He says he is not responsible for what happened. Can't you make the Clave believe him too?"
There was a long pause. "I cannot assure the Clave of what I do not know myself," said Jem.
"They must ask him what happened," said Cordelia. "They must try the mortal sword. Will they?"
Jem hesitated. Cordelia saw that Lucy was approaching them, just as she realized she had mashed the herbs in the mortar into green sludge.
"Daisy,"
Lucy said in a low voice. This struck Cordelia as alarming. Lucy could rarely be convinced to whisper about anything.
"Could you come with me a moment? I very much need your assistance."
"Of course," Cordelia said a bit hesitantly. "It is only that..." She turned toward Jem, hoping to get his answer to her question, but he had already vanished into the crowded sick room.
"Where are we going?"
Cordelia whispered as they hurried along the corridors of the Institute.
"Lucy, you cannot simply abduct me, you know."
"Nonsense," said Lucy. "If I wish to abduct you, you can be sure that I would do it quite expertly, no doubt beneath the veil of silence and darkness." They had reached the vestibule. Lucy took down a cloak from a peg on the wall and handed another to Cordelia.
"Besides, I told my father I was taking you home in the carriage because you faint at the sight of blood." "Lucy!"
Cordelia followed her friend out into the courtyard. The sun had only just set, and the evening was brushed with a steel blue patina The yard was crowded with carriages, each bearing the crest of a shadow hunter family. "Not every bit of a good story is true," said Lucy. Her cheeks were bright pink. The air had become chill. Cordelia pulled her cloak around her. "It's the story that's important." "I don't want to go home, though," Cordelia pointed out, as she and Lucy wove their way through the crowd of carriages. She squinted. "Is someone singing inside the Baybrook carriage?" Lucy waved a dismissive hand. "Of course you're not going home. You're coming with me on an adventure." She waved at something half hidden behind the Wentworth carriage. "Bridget!" It was indeed Bridget, her greying red hair wound into a chignon, having clearly just finished readying the Institute's broom and a fresh horse, Balios's brother, Xanthos. The two were a matched pair. Cordelia had heard a great deal about them growing up. Lucy went instantly to pat Xanthos's soft, white-speckled nose. Cordelia tried to smile at Bridget, who was eyeing them both suspiciously. "Carriage all ready for you, Miss Baggage," Bridget said to Lucy. "Try not to get in trouble. It fusses your parents." "I'm just taking Cordelia home," Lucy said, blinking innocently. Bridget wandered off, muttering about finding certain people stuck in certain trees while sneaking out of certain windows. Lucy bent to whisper something in Xanthos's ear before gesturing for Cordelia to join her in the carriage. "It's all glamoured," she explained, as the broom rattled under the open gate and into the streets of London. "It would just upset the mundanes to see a carriage racing about with no driver." "So the horse knows where to take us?" Cordelia settled back against the upholstered bench seat. "But it's not to Cornwall Gardens." Lucy shook her head. "Balios and Xanthos are special horses, and we're going to Chiswick House." Cordelia stared. "Chiswick House? We're going to see Grace and Tatiana? Oh, Lucy, I don't know." Lucy held up a hand. "There could be a time, a short time, during which you may have to distract them. But it is not a social call. I am on a mission." Cordelia did not think Grace seemed the sort of person who could easily be distracted. "I shan't," she said firmly. "Not unless you tell me what this mission is." Lucy was silent for a moment, her face small and pale in the shadows of the carriage. "You know, I can see ghosts," she said, and hesitated. Cordelia blinked. It was the last thing she'd expected Lucy to say. Ghosts were something all shadow hunters knew existed, and when ghosts wanted to be seen, most Nephilim could see them. But the Herondales had a special ability. Will, James, and Lucy could all see ghosts that didn't want to be seen. "Yes, but what? A ghost told me," Lucy broke off for a moment. "Jessamine told me there is a ghost at Chiswick House that might know about these daylight demons," she said at last. "Daisy, I have to do something for Barbara and the others. I cannot just sit about passing out tinctures. If there is anything I can do to help, I must do it." "Of course, but why not tell your father or your mother? They would surely understand." "I do not wish to raise hopes that may come to nothing," said Lucy. "Besides, they might feel they needed to tell some of the others, and I have been told that being sought out by ghosts is not an appealing trait in a young woman." Cordelia caught at Lucy's hand with her own bandaged one. "Tell me who said that to you. I will kill them." Lucy sniffled and then laughed. "You needn't kill anyone. Just come with me to Chiswick, and I will be perfectly satisfied."
"We must bar the doors," said James. "They don't lock and we can't be interrupted." He frowned. "Matthew, can you stand?" The ballroom had been closed up after the ball. It was rarely used except for social functions. The room was warm and close as James, Christopher and Thomas threw off their jackets and stripped down to shirt sleeves. Most were still wearing the same weapon belts they'd had on in the park. James had added several new daggers to his own. Only Matthew was unarmed. Blinking and dishevelled, he found his way to a plushly upholstered chair and fell into it. "I am quite all right," he said, waving an airy hand. "Please continue with your plan." He squinted. "What was your plan?" "I'll tell you in a moment," James said. He was quite sure none of them were going to like it. "Thomas?" Thomas nodded, seized hold of a heavy sideboard, and began to shove it in front of the ballroom doors. Christopher looked worriedly at Matthew. "Perhaps some water?" he said. "I am quite all right," Matthew repeated. "I found you drinking from a flask and singing Elsie from Chelsea in the Baybrooks' carriage," said Thomas darkly. "It was private there," said Matthew, "and well upholstered. At least it wasn't the Bridgestocks' carriage, because they have already experienced enough tragedy today." "Nothing bad has happened to the Baybrooks," said Christopher with great sincerity. "Nothing until now," said James. "Christopher, was everything all right, dropping off Miss Blackthorn?" He tried not to sound as if he were too invested in the answer. Matthew raised an eyebrow but said nothing. "Oh, perfectly," said Christopher. "I told her all about culturing bacteria, and she was so fascinated that she never spoke a word." James had gone to pile chairs in front of the doors to the withdrawing room. He hoped Grace had not expired from boredom. "Did you have to tell Mrs. Blackthorn what had happened at the park? She can't have been pleased." Christopher shook his head. "I confess I didn't see her. Miss Blackthorn asked that I drop her at the gates, not the front door." "She probably doesn't want anyone to see the state of the place," said Matthew, yawning. "The gates alone are festooned in rust." James eyed him. "Thomas," he said in a low voice, "maybe a healing rune?" Thomas nodded and approached Matthew cautiously, as one might approach a stray cat on the street. Some time ago, James had discovered that healing runes sobered Matthew up. Not entirely, but enough. "Push up your sleeve, then, there's a good fellow," Thomas said, seating himself on the arm of Matthew's chair. "Let's wake you up, and James can tell us whatever mad thing he has planned." Done with the chairs, James cast a glance around the room, dusted off his hands, and said, "We'd better check the locks on all the windows, just to be sure." "It seems somehow blasphemous to use marks to rid oneself of the effects of alcohol," Matthew added, as Thomas put his steely away. The mark in question gleamed, new-made, on Matthew's wrist. He looked already more clear-eyed, and less as if he were about to fall asleep or be sick. "I've seen you use your steely to part your hair," said James dryly, as he began to examine the window locks. "The angel gave me this hair," replied Matthew. "It's one of the Shadow Hunter's gifts, like the mortal sword." "Now that is blasphemy," said Thomas. Christopher had joined James in checking the window fastenings, though James desperately wished he could open one and get some air into the room. "A thing of beauty is a joy forever, Thomas," said Matthew. "James, why are we locking all the windows? Are we afraid of over-curious pigeons?" James slammed a bolt home and turned to look at the others. "I have spent the past 4 years of my life trying to train myself not to do what I am about to do. I don't wish to even consider the possibility of being interrupted." "By a pigeon?" said Matthew. But the look in his eyes was sympathetic, despite his lightly mocking words. "Jamie, what are we doing here?" James took a deep breath. "I am going to deliberately send myself into the Shadow Realm," he said. The Merry Thieves exploded in a chorus of protest. Matthew stood up, his eyes glittering. "Certainly not," he said. "The danger..." "I do not think there will be danger," said James. "I have been in and out of the Shadow Realm many times in my life. It has been ages since I fell accidentally into that world. Yet in the past week, I have seen it 3 times, once just before the attack today. I cannot think that is a coincidence. If I can use this ability to help Barbara, Ariadne, all of us, you must let me do it." "Bloody hell," Matthew rubbed at his eyes. If we don't help you here, you'll just try to do this after we've all gone, won't you?
Clearly, said James. He tapped the daggers at his waist. I'm armed, at least.
Matthew twisted the signet ring on his finger, marked with MF. It had been a gift from James when they had become parabatai, and he tended to fiddle with it only when distressed.
Very well, James. As you wish.
James cleared his throat.
All right, let's get on with it.
He was met with the gaze of six expectant eyes.
Well, Thomas said hopefully after a long pause, go on into the shadow realm then.
James concentrated. He stared at the blank floor and tried to conjure up images in his mind of the shadow realm. The scorched grey sky and dimmed sun. He imagined the ballroom wrong, the windows set oddly into the walls, the chandeliers melting and sagging. He opened his eyes and yelled. A pair of eyes were staring directly into his, so close that he could make out the details inside the green irises, the faint splotches of brown and black.
Matthew!
I really don't think staring at him is going to help, Matthew, said Thomas, and Matthew took a reluctant step back from his parapetai.
Jamie, is there anything that might help you begin the process? We've all seen you do it. You start to get shadowy and turn a bit blurry around the edges.
When I go into the shadow realm, the realness of my presence here begins to fade, James said. He did not mention that in the past he had faded enough in this world to pass through a solid wall. He did not intend to do it again.
But it is not what drives me into the shadow realm. More of a side effect of being there.
Often it happens when you are upset or shocked, said Christopher.
I suppose we could try upsetting or shocking you.
Given everything that's happened, that shouldn't be too hard, said James.
Nonsense, said Matthew, hopping up on a nearby occasional table.
It was quite frail-looking, with thin, gold-painted wooden legs, and James eyed it worriedly.
The last time I saw you shocked was when that Iblis demon was sending Christopher love letters.
I have a dark charm, said Christopher sadly.
Please recall that I am the pale neurasthenic one, and you are the stern heroic one, Matthew said to James. It is very tedious when you mix up our roles. We will have to think of something quite impressive to startle you.
So what is my role? Said Christopher.
Mad inventor, of course, said Matthew promptly. And Thomas is the one with a good heart.
Lord, I sound dull, said Thomas.
Look, James, come here for a second.
James moved toward Thomas, who seemed to have decided on something. In moments like this, he looked very like his mother, with her brilliant hazel eyes and ferocious mouth. A fist came sailing out of the air and landed squarely in James's solar plexus. He went flying backward, hitting the floor with a gasp. His head swam. Matthew dropped down by his side as James heaved himself up onto his elbows, gasping. The pain wasn't bad, but the feeling of trying to catch his breath was sickening.
Thomas, Matthew yelled. What were you trying to...
I was trying to surprise him, Thomas yelled back.
This is important, Matthew.
He darted a worried look at James, belying his angry words. You don't mind, do you, Jamie?
It's all right, James said breathlessly. Only it didn't work. If I turned into a shadow every time something hit me, I couldn't patrol.
He stared up at the ceiling, which had mirrors on it. He could see himself lying splayed on the parquet, hair very black against the white, Matthew kneeling over him like a squire over the body of a dead knight. He could see Christopher and Thomas in the mirror as well, or at least the tops of their heads. Christopher was reaching up to pull something down from the wall. Thomas had his arms crossed. Matthew jumped to his feet with the agility of a fox and held out a hand to help James up after him. James had only just regained his footing when an arrow shot past his head. One of the windows shattered, and Matthew threw himself against James. They tumbled to the floor again, knocking the breath out of James for the second time in 5 minutes. He rolled into a sitting position, shouldering Matthew aside to find Thomas goggling at Christopher, who was clutching one of the bows that had been hanging on the wall.
In case anyone was wondering if those were purely ornamental, said James, getting to his feet, they are not.
In the name of a million bloody angels, Christopher, what the hell did you just do? Matthew demanded, leaping up after James. Did you try to kill James?
Christopher lowered the bow. James thought he could hear noises in the institute, doors slamming in the distance and running feet. Bloody hell.
I was not trying to kill James, said Christopher in an injured tone. I was hoping the shock of the arrow flying past would startle him into the shadow realm. Pity it didn't work. We must think of a new plan to grievously alarm James at once.
Christopher, James exclaimed, I cannot believe you would say that. I also cannot believe you would shoot at me.
It had a 72% chance of working, in perfect laboratory conditions.
We are not in perfect laboratory conditions, James shouted. We are in the ballroom of my house.
At that moment, the doors of the ballroom rattled.
What's going on?
It was Will's voice.
James, are you in there?
Bloody hell, my father, James said, casting about. Look, all of you get out through the windows. Well, the broken one anyway.
I'll take the blame. I'll say I shot the window out.
In the ballroom, Thomas said practically. Why would you do such a rattle-headed thing?
I'm capable of anything.
James made a grab for Christopher's bow. Christopher ran around behind Thomas as if his friend were a maypole.
Come on, Kit, give it over.
Thomas rolled his eyes.
He's going to say, because I'm a Herondale, isn't he?
The pounding on the door increased. James turned his fiercest glare on the others.
I am a Herondale, he said. And I am telling you to get out of my institute, so the only one who gets punished here is me. Answer me, James, Will shouted. Why have you blocked this door? I demand to know what's going on.
James isn't here, Matthew called, moving closer to him. Go away! James looked at Matthew, puzzled.
Really? I heard breaking glass, Will called.
I was practicing fighting moves, Matthew answered.
In the ballroom?
We're trying to distract Thomas. It's been a very emotional day, Matthew shouted back.
What?
Will's voice was incredulous.
Don't you blame this on me, Thomas whispered.
James. Matthew put his hands on James's shoulders and turned James toward him. Now that the window of the ballroom was shattered, cooler air came in, lifting Matthew's sweat-dampened hair off his forehead. His eyes were intent, black in the dimness, fixed on James. James found himself startling at the seriousness of Matthew's gaze.
If you're going to do this, you need to do it now.
I know, James said. Math, help me. It was an old nickname for Matthew, given to him by Will, after the Welsh king, Math Ap Mathanwy, the keeper of all wisdom and knower of all things. Will always said Matthew had been born knowing too much. There was a dark awareness in his gaze now, as he leaned in toward James's ear.
Jamie, he whispered, I'm sorry to have to do this.
He swallowed.
You are cursed, a child of demons. It is why you can see the shadow realm. You are seeing the place you belong.
James jerked back, staring at Matthew. Matthew, who smelled of brandy and familiarity. Matthew, who could be cruel, but never to James. James's vision began to slide into greyness. Matthew went white.
James, he said, I didn't mean it.
But James could no longer feel Matthew's hands on his shoulders. He could no longer feel the ballroom floor under his feet. The doors of the ballroom were beginning to crack open, but he could no longer hear them. The world had gone monochrome. James saw broken black walls, a splintered floor, and dust that glittered like dull jewels scattered across the place where Barbara had fallen. He bent to reach for it, as the universe jerked beneath his feet, and he was thrust forward into nothingness.